Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
WebEx ist mit Cisco Security ausgestattet, sodass Ihre Videokonferenzen immer vertraulich sind. Kostenlos testen unter cisco.de/workfromhome. Wenn Arbeiten von zu Hause sicher sein soll, ist WebEx unerlässlich.
Welcome to the World Book Club podcast. I'm Harriet Gilbert, and this month, the seventh in our year-long celebration of writing by women, we've been reading an epic novel called Girl, Woman, Other, in which a massed choir of voices, almost all female, almost all black, tell the stories of their lives and loves. Lives and loves that often collide with each other's in unexpected ways. Published only last year, the novel's been a massive success. It won the Booker Prize for fiction, it was nominated by Barack Obama as a favourite read of 2019, and it's the first ever novel by a female writer of colour to top the UK fiction paperback chart. Corona restrictions mean the author's going to be talking with us from her home. I'm also in my home, and all around the world in their homes are readers of Girl, Woman, Other, eagerly waiting for its author to answer their questions about it. So, without more delay, let me introduce her. This month's guest is the British writer Bernardine Evaristo.
Hello, Bernardine. Everybody.
Well, welcome to World Book Club. How have you been coping with all this lockdown business?
Yeah, I feel very privileged, actually, because my lockdown has been pretty good. I had to spend some time looking after an elderly relative, and that was a worry. But other than that, I've been able to do a lot of things virtually, which has been great. And, you know, the weather in the UK has been great for a couple of months now. And I found it very peaceful. And yeah, it's not been a bad experience for me. But of course, it is a bad experience for a lot of people out there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And to your novel, which does the opposite of locking down. What it does is open up this whole range of different worlds. We get the world of a high-flying businesswoman concealing a childhood trauma, for instance, or of a young, idealistic teacher whose dreams become rather battered at the edges, or the ancient matriarch of a North Country farming family, Hattie. I'm particularly fond of her. But all 12 characters in Girl, Woman, Other have these terrific stories about love and sex and ambition and friendship. And that's just the main characters. There's a whole cast of secondary characters, friends, husbands, partners, jostling away at the edges of the novel. But Bernardine, could we go first to the character whose story starts things off? She's a middle-aged black writer called Amma, who, after decades struggling as a dramatist trying to break her way into the mainstream, has finally got a play opening at the prestigious National Theatre in London. And your novel begins with her striding out on her way to the theatre.
It certainly does. Amma is walking along the promenade of the waterway that bisects her city. A few early morning barges cruise slowly by. To her left is the nautical-themed footbridge with deck-like walkway and sailing mast pylons. To her right is the bend in the river as it heads east past Waterloo Bridge towards the Dome of St Paul's. She feels the sun begin to rise, the air still breezy before the city clogs up with heat and fumes. A violinist plays something suitably uplifting further along the promenade. Amma's play, The Last Amazon of Dahomey, opens at the National tonight. She thinks back to when she started out in theatre, when she and her running mate Dominique developed a reputation for heckling shows that offended their political sensibilities. Their powerfully trained actors' voices projected from the back of the stalls before they made a quick getaway. They believed in protest. That was public, disruptive, and downright annoying to those at the other end of it. She remembers pouring a pint of beer over the head of a director whose play featured semi-naked black women running around on stage behaving like idiots, before doing a runner into the back streets of Hammersmith, howling.
Bernardine Evaristo, thank you very much indeed for that. And that's a great description with which your novel opens of a certain part of London. And so, fittingly enough, our first question for you comes from a Londoner. She rang this into the programme, and her name is Lauren Ace.
Hello, Bernardine. My name's Lauren. I live in London, but I'm from South Wales originally. I absolutely loved Girl, Woman, Other. It was the best novel that I read last year. The thing that I really loved about it was how you examine such a vast spectrum of womanhood through your cast of characters. And I thought the way that you wove their stories together was just absolutely masterful. So did you start with one character, and if so, who, and then expand out from them? Thanks so much.
So, Bernardine, did you start with just one character and expand out from there?
I did. Although the longer answer to that question is that I was commissioned to write a short story. And as I wrote this short story, I realised that it was possibly the beginning of a novel. And one of the characters, Carol, was the starting point for the novel. So it was this idea of a woman who was in the business world, who was black and struggling to succeed. The next character was Shirley. Shirley is Carol's schoolteacher. So, and through Shirley, her mother Winsome emerged. So it kind of grew very organically. I'm not the kind of person who will sit down and write 100 notes or post-its or anything like that. I'll have some basic ideas and then I'll allow the act of writing to sort of reveal the story to me. Oh, just to say that initially I was going to have a cast of 1,000 women, and then I reduced it to 100, and then eventually... I know, crazy. And then eventually reduced it to 12.
You say that at one point you were going to have 1,000 women, 1,000 characters in this book. We have a question now that was rung into World Book Club from Nigeria by Steve Ogar, who is interested in the question of the number of characters you have in the book.
Hello, Bernardine. I am Steve Ogar, a writer from Cross River in Nigeria. I just want to know why you chose to follow 12 women. Why not less or more? What's the significance of this number? Thank you for finding time for this question.
So, Bernardine, why 12? Why not 11, 13? Why not 1,000?
Yes. Well, 1,000 was crazy. But, you know, Toni Morrison said at some point, you know, try to think the unthinkable. And so that to me was an unthinkable number. And then I thought, well, I could do it through poetry, perhaps. But anyway, I soon got rid of that idea. What I discovered was that I could tell the reader a lot about their lives in about 30 pages. So I had to be very disciplined, any more than that, and I was going to have to reduce the number of stories I wanted to tell. And for me, the whole point of the book was to cram as many Black British women into a novel as I could, because I was writing out of an absence, because we're just simply not very present in British literature, or international literature for that matter. And so... then it made sense for me to have about 12 of them. And also I wanted to have this sort of diverse representation of womanhood. And so by the time I got to the 12th character, I realised I had that. And if I were to write more characters, then the book would be too big.
Well, Bernardine, thank you. And Steve, that's the answer to your question. Now, we have somebody on the phone now from Liverpool, Sarah Hughes.
Hi, Bernardine. I really enjoyed the multi-generational aspect of the novel. How important was it for you that the characters spoke from so many different perspectives? And was it your intention to hopefully bridge those divides by letting us into so many varied experiences?
Yes. So the answer to the second question is absolutely that was my intention. And the idea of it being multi-generational was really important to me, because yet again, I spoke earlier about speaking to absences. We don't get many Black British women in fiction anyway, let alone middle-aged women and let alone older women. In fact, older women are really quite invisible in British fiction. So it was really important to me that I had a spread of the generations. So the youngest is 19, as you know, and the oldest is 93. And then there is every generation represented in between. Because what I was doing was giving equal weight to each of the women at whatever age and stage they were in their lives. And as it happened, there are four mother-daughter relationships. So not only is it multi-generational, but it's also about these relationships between women. So it's intergenerational in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I loved about it, the fact that between, say, like Amma's daughter, how she's very much like Amma was at that age, but then Amma obviously grows out of it. So I found that wonderful.
yes, and I'm also interested in how we grow as we get older, how we develop, how our lives change. You know, Amma has these friends who are part of her lesbian community, but they don't all stay as lesbians, and some of them become quite conservative in their outlook. And for me, that was a really important thing to explore, because certainly when I was young, I thought that how things were was how things were going to be forever. You know, I did not have the vision of myself even in 10 years in the future, let alone, you know, at the age of 90 or something.
Yes. Sarah, thank you very much indeed for calling. And I should say, Bernadine, that we also had an email from Fiona Vera Gray in Durham. She just says, thank you for giving me something that made me feel like I had a community of women in my head when I was stuck in the house with none.
Oh, nice, nice.
Anyway, we now have another caller on the telephone from Accra in Ghana. It's Elikem Kisser. Are you there, Elikem? Can I just say happy birthday to you?
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much, Harriet. Thank you,
Bernadine. Elikem, your question for Bernadine.
Looking at how diverse the characters of this book are, one would reckon that it takes the entire lives of each character to know them the way Bernadine knows them. How long did the research for this book take?
Oh, if I'm really honest, there wasn't a lot of research. I'm 61 years old, so I have lived quite a long time. So I have just known a lot of people. And in a sense, the research was done before the book was written. That said, yes, there was some research in the more traditional sense. So, for example, Hattie is a farmer in the north of the country, and she's lived to the age of 93. And I go back to her childhood and also her mother's life. And I did have to do research for that because I know nothing about farming. And I know nothing about the countryside, really, other than, you know, passing through it and occasionally spending time in it. So I had to do, it's really hard trying to research farming in Britain in the 1940s and 50s, for example. And then Carol is a banker. And I know nothing about finance. I'm sort of innumerate, really. I can't add up. I just get confused when it comes to anything to do with numbers. And then Amma, you know, she's coming out of the 1980s, very much sort of radical, feminist, countercultural movement. I was part of that. So I didn't need to do any research. I just drew on my own memories of it.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you too.
We have another question. Now, this one was rung into BBC World Book Club from York in the north of England. It's from Laura McDonough, and here she is to ask it.
Hi, Bernadine. My name is Laura McDonough, and I'm based in York in the UK. For me, one of the most impressive aspects of Girl, Woman, Other was the scope and the diversity of the voices, and in particular, how you really captured those contemporary Gen Z voices. I'm thinking about Yaz and Morgan in particular. I would love to know a little bit more about your process. How do you test your writing out to ensure that it sounds totally authentic? Thanks, Bernadine.
Yes.
So, Bernadine, do you corral young people in and say, OK, is this how you would talk? I mean, how do you get... Because it's one thing you having been a teenager yourself, but you weren't a teenager in the late 20th, early 21st century, and their language, their attitudes are different.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, I teach. I'm a professor of creative writing at Brunel University, London. You know, every intake is 18 or 19 every year, and I've been there 10 years. So there's a lot about young people that I absorb through their work and through my interaction with them. And so while I'm getting older, they're staying the same age, if you see what I mean. So all of that, again, goes into the mix when I think about creating these characters. And sometimes I do test what I write with the young people. And I did do that with this book. I did it with Yaz because she is emblematic of that kind of feisty, woke young person who really expects the world to fall at her feet in a sense and has a lot of privilege and doesn't really understand the complexity and the nuance of life yet. She gave me a lot of fun. I found her very funny. So it was like, how do you write that sort of character with dignity and with respect, but also bring them alive as fully fledged kind of riotous figures that where you're also kind of gently poking fun at them. So it's not easy to do it, but I think, you know, I also write older characters. My last book was about a gay Caribbean man in his 70s. So for me, that is what I do as a writer. I create these characters who are not myself.
Well, as you say, Bernadine, the two youngest characters are Yaz, Amma's wonderfully sort of argumentative and self-opinionated daughter, who I really like, but also Megan Morgan. Well, if we could have a reading about her, she's a schoolgirl. She's really uncomfortable in her skin, and what she's uncomfortable with is being labelled, whether it's to do with her race, or even more, whether it's to do with her gender, to do with what's expected of her as a female.
Megan herself was fifth generation on the Ethiopian side, third generation on the African-American side, and second generation on the Malawian side, which felt weird when you broke it down, because essentially she was just a complete human being and as English as anyone. Most people assumed she was mixed race. It was easier to let them think it. The girls at school cooed over Megan's natural suntan, which they tried to emulate by spending their pocket money lying on sunbeds. Likewise with their curly perms, trying to unsuccessfully reproduce her glossy blonde corkscrew curls. She had it made, really, according to her classmates. The boys liked her too. Then her body started to show womanly curves, and it didn't feel right. It wasn't what she felt herself to be. So much so that she hated catching herself in mirrors, hated the breasts that appeared without her permission. She thought she'd grow into her body. It began to repulse her. At 16, she shaved off her hair to see what it felt like, loved running her hands over her new low-maintenance bristle. She felt free, weightless, herself.
Bernadine Evaristo, thank you very much. And on the telephone now from Luxembourg, we have Laurie Rooney. Laurie, hi, you've got a question for Bernadine.
Hi, Bernadine. First of all, I absolutely loved the book. And I have many questions about many of the characters, but one that I just wanted to ask about was Nzinga and her relationship with Dominique.
Now, Nzinga is this stunning, very amazing, powerful-looking African-American woman that the British Dominique falls head over heels in love with the first time she meets her. Mm-hmm. And she becomes very controlling and manipulative of Dominique de Nzinga. What's going on there?
Well, I think it's pronounced Nzinga. I'm not 100% sure, but that's how I pronounce it. I wanted to explore a really toxic relationship between women, because I think there is a myth that relationships between women are somehow perfect, and that the kind of power play that we know exists in heterosexual relationships won't exist when you get two women together. And that's nonsense, of course, because anything that can happen in heterosexual relationships can also happen in gay relationships. So I wanted to explore that. Dominique is a powerful woman who is then weakened by being in this relationship with somebody who seems to be more powerful than her, although ultimately it transpires that this woman isn't more powerful than her, not in the long term. I was also exploring female friendship, you know, because Dominique is great friends with Amma. They've been friends for many years, and yet a relationship comes between them, and that is a relationship with another woman, not a relationship with a man. But the dynamics of a relationship where somebody is coercively controlling is really interesting to explore. And the way in which they cut other people off, out of the picture, you know, they isolate the individual in order to assume even more power and control over them. As a writer of fiction, the last thing you want to do is to write happy relationships. That's not interesting. Nobody wants to read it, honest to God. It's like, why are you telling me this? You want to know about the difficulties in relationships. You know, conflict is the life and soul of fiction. And also smash what's possibly a myth about, or certainly an idealization about, lesbian relationships, knowing full well that a lot of people coming to my book will probably not have read about black lesbian relationships, because how many books can we name where black lesbians are featured?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a reader, it was really gripping. And what also sprung to mind was perhaps it was karma, because early in the book, it's introduced that Dominique makes up an abusive relationship with her father in order to secure accommodation. And I thought maybe it was a vengeance for that.
I hadn't thought of that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Serves you right, yeah. Dominique.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Laurie, thank you for your question and thank you for your answer, Bernadine. Mm-hmm. Bernadine, we were going to hear from Anissa Belgrove now, who's a nurse in Coral Springs in Florida. She's originally from Trinidad, but being a nurse, as you can imagine at this time, she suddenly had other preoccupations, so she couldn't speak to you. But her question is, she's talking about one of your characters, Shirley. And now, Shirley's mother, at one point in the book, starts a sexual relationship with Shirley's husband, i.e. with the mother's son-in-law. She's never found out, and eventually she stops the relationship, but it does carry on for a while. And Anissa wanted to ask you, as the story developed for you as a writer, what triggered the character to behave in this manner? I must admit, Bernadine, when I came to that part of the book, I said, what? Really? Sleeping with your son-in-law?
Yeah, it makes for a really good story. Winsome, out of probably all the characters in the book, is the most recognisable in that she is an older woman of the Windrush generation. And in the UK now, most people know about the Windrush generation, you know, the people from the Caribbean who came to Britain from the late 1940s and settled here. And people might think, oh, yes, I know her. I know this kind of woman. I can imagine who she is. But that's not going to make a good story for her to be the person they think she is. And what's really interesting about human behaviour is that everybody's got secrets. People do things that are morally, you know, dubious or even reprehensible. And, you know, they also act out of character and also just keep a lot of things buried that never come to light. When I think about my grandmother, born in the 1900s, and she died in 1986, she took her secrets to the grave because her generation never talked about anything intimate at all, ever. And Winsome isn't quite that old, but she is of a generation where women are presenting themselves in one way to society, but actually there's a lot more going on beneath the surface. And so for her to do that to her daughter and to justify it, it's the ultimate betrayal almost, isn't it? And yet she does
it. It's pretty terrible.
It was very spicy for me to write. And I love the idea that people are shocked and horrified.
Bernadine, thank you. We had a tweet to BBC World Book Club from Tyrrell Johnson in Kelowna in British Columbia in Canada. And this is it. He says, each character in Girl, Woman, Other feels so compelling and real. My question is whether there was one character that was easiest or most fun to write.
Yes.
You've kind of intimated that it might have been the kid, Jazz.
Jazz was the most fun to write because Jazz is so young and current. The easiest character to write was Amma, because Amma is kind of very, very loosely, I am not Amma, but very, very loosely based on my younger self. And so I was writing about a period that I lived through. Amma goes to these clubs. I used to go to those clubs. I didn't dress like Amma, but I had a similar kind of social circle. I lived in short life housing, which is one step up from squats. So for me, it was a trip down memory lane and a way for me to memorialise that era.
That's so interesting, because we had an email from Wendy Allen saying, I loved the character of Amma, and asking how much it was based upon you. And actually, it made me think in many ways. I mean, we meet Amma when she, you know, she's been sort of struggling to get into the mainstream with her playwriting. And finally, there she is. She's in the mainstream. She's at the National Theatre. She's got a play opening there. Now, you couldn't have known it, of course, at the time, but there you were as a writer who's been very, very praised, but on the margins of bestsellerdom, as it were. You got the Booker Prize. Your book is a massive bestseller. So, I mean, in a way, Amma was a kind of prophecy.
I think so. You know, it's life imitating art. It's quite surreal, actually. And, of course, my dream for a long time has been to break through. And I'm literally living through this moment right now. And it began when I won the... Well, it began when I was shortlisted for the Booker and then winning it with Margaret Atwood and everything that's happened ever since. It's been surreal. I began, as Amma did, feeling very much like an outsider and rejected, if you like, by mainstream culture. And then I end up at the heart of everything right now. The last thing I can accuse anyone of is marginalising me. It's a really good feeling for it to happen after 40 years. I tell you, it's extremely sweet.
It's so nice that you're so happy about it, rather than saying, oh, you know, the burden of fame and all that stuff. Well, Bernardine Evaristo, we've got a question that was rung into World Book Club by Olivia Maidment, who belongs to a group called London Book Women. And this is the question.
Hi, Bernardine. I'm Liv Maidment, the founder of London Book Women. The club's uniting feature is that all of us are women living on boats in London. Here is my question for you. Was there a particular voice or particular elements of various different voices that you as a writer felt most resonated with you at this point or at different points in your life? Mainly, I just wanted to tell you that I love your book, and for what it's worth, everyone loved your book. It was the first one we read together and remains the only one that we all agreed we loved. Thank you.
Olivia Maidment, who belongs to this fascinating book club. It's all women who live on boats in London. She wanted to know, as indeed somebody else emailed in to know, whether there were voices or one particular voice that resonated with you more than others.
I think I'd probably say Hattie, because Hattie is sort of the polar opposite of me and anyone I've ever known. And we simply do not get representations of black women in the countryside, really, hardly at all. And certainly not a great old woman who is formidable and living on her own in the north of England, the furthest you can go in the north of England. And so I always talk about my two favourite characters being Yaz and Hattie for very, very different reasons. I actually feel incredibly proud of Hattie because I have created this woman living in this rural environment who is of such a great age, who has been brought into being by me, in a sense. You know, we're very different to America, where most black people, say, in the 19th century and early 20th century, were living rural lives. Our lives in this country have been urban and in the metropolis. And it's hard, I think, for people to imagine us outside of that. And Hattie is somebody who is... She's lived on the same farm for 93 years, all her life, and it's been in her family for 200 years. So she's so British.
I love her. She's so blithely imperious when she does have the family around her for meals. She's taking no notice of them as they sort of munch away. She just thinks, look at them, they're so greedy.
Yes.
She's gorgeous. But you've also, Bernardine, answered a question from Julia Dangour in London, who also wanted to know which character resonated with you most. And got another caller on the phone. It's Kim Inglis in London. Kim, hi. Your question for Bernardine.
Yes, hello. Hello, Bernardine. My reading
hi.
Group has just read and discussed Girl, Woman, Other, and we all thoroughly enjoyed it. We would, however, ask you to elucidate further on the lack of punctuation. Half the group found that the book had a natural rhythm and had no problem reading it. The other half found it difficult to read and had to keep going back to reread sections. Could you give us some insight into why you wrote like this and what you were hoping to achieve with limited punctuation?
Yes. So I think I've invented this form, that's what I keep saying, nobody's contradicted me, called a fusion fiction, which is how I describe the novel, because there are very few full stops, very few capital letters, quite a lot of commas, and the spacing of the language on the page is kind of a bit like poetry, but it's not poetry. And so the language is kind of fused together in that sense. And what I find about that form, it gives me a lot of freedom as a writer. So it allowed me to explore the women's lives in those 30 pages I think, a lot more comprehensively than if I had written the book in traditional sentences and paragraphs, because that would have been very containing and constraining. And the free-flowing form, whatever people want to call it, just allowed me to go all over the place, you know. And it is a bit like a stream of consciousness novel. And then also I call it a fusion fiction because of the ways in which the women's stories fuse with each other's, because they are all interconnected. Generally speaking, people seem to get over the style of the book. So a lot of people say after a while they didn't notice it. And to me, that's great, because what that means is they've just accepted that this is the form and they're just in the story. I'm an experimental writer, but my books have to be readable. I'm not interested in writing for people who've got PhDs in experimental novels. That doesn't interest me. I'm interested in my books reaching as many people as possible, because I feel that the stories I have to tell are very important.
Were you one of the people who found it easy enough to read, Kim?
Yeah, I found exactly what Bernadine just said, that I went with the flow and it was not a problem. But a couple of our members said that they did tend to get lost and then they'd have to go back and reread sections, and they didn't seem to find the rhythm.
Okay. I find, Bernadine, that you used the line break, if you like, rather like punctuation. So I mean, yeah. I'm just going to read this tiny bit. This is Dominic, who's lesbian, and you say of her, "She tried boys a couple of times," new line, "they enjoyed it," new line, "she endured it." Well, Kim, thank you very much for your question. A question now for you, Bernadine, from the writer who actually abridged Girl, Woman, Other for the radio, for BBC Radio 4, Pat Cumper. Well, she says, "Girl, Woman, Other flows so well. What did it take to make the writing feel so effortless?"
Wow. Well, hello, Pat. I really loved your abridgment of the novel. Thank you very, very much for that. How did I make it appear effortless? Girl, Woman, Other is my eighth book. So I guess when you reach that stage, there is a lot of skill that goes into it. So it can appear effortless, but actually I started writing professionally for theatre in 1982. So it's nearly 40 years of effort that goes into this book that makes it appear effortless.
I think it was the American novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne who said, "Easy reading is damn hard writing." a lot of work goes into making something seem effortless.
Yes, yes.
We've got an email for you now, Bernadine, from a Gambian listener to the BBC World Service who is currently resident in Tunis, in Tunisia, Alassane Diallo. And he asks you, in fact, this is a question that so many people are interested in with different authors. He asks, how long did it take you to write the novel?
So it took me 5 years. So it was a long time. Partly because it's a very ambitious book with all these different characters, and I needed to give myself breathing space between each character's story. So it's not as if I created Amma and then I went straight into Yaz and straight into Dominique. I needed to have some space in my head. Then again, I am a writer who does lots of things other than write. And I have to accept that it's in my nature to want to do lots of other things. You know, I'm an academic. I also am very active in the arts. I sit on committees. I judge prizes. I set up diversity initiatives. I take on commissions. I do all kinds of things. If you were to say to me, Bernadine, the next 5 years you have to write your next novel and I don't want you to do anything else, I would probably run into the road screaming, because that would be a nightmare to me.
Bernadine, thank you. And Omar Abushiri, who's a Kenyan living in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, has sent in this question for you. It's quite simple. Could you explain the title of this book, please? Girl, Woman, Other?
That title was a long time coming. My original title was Afro-Saxon Amazons. And I, even to this day, I love it as a title, but I don't think there was a single person I told it to who agreed with me. People said, it makes me think of Amazon the retailer. Oh, God's sake. And eventually I came up with Girl, Woman, Other. What I wanted was a title that told people something about the book before they picked it up. So there's a book at the moment called Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. It's currently the best-selling title in Britain because the Black Lives Matter movement has, you know, made it shoot up something like 300 places to the top of the charts. In a sense, the book's title does the work for it. And I wanted this book, which by the time I'd finished writing it, felt topical, although it wasn't when I started it. I have to make that point. I didn't write it because I thought, oh, black women are topical. So girl refers to the fact that all of the women, or Womaxon, I actually call them Womaxon, which is a trans-inclusive term for women of colour. Okay, because for everyone who's read the book, they'll know that not everyone is strictly black. And then they nearly all become women. And then the other is whatever you think it is, really. For me, the other is that as black women, they are othered in this society. And then they might be othered on account of their class, being working class, or on account of their sexuality, on account of them being immigrants. And then again, they may other each other because they are not all in agreement in the book.
Ah, Bernadine, you talk about women othering each other, which absolutely feeds into this next question we've got for you. It's from Gayatri Jayaraman, who's in Mumbai.
Hi, Bernadine. Gayatri here from Mumbai, India. I loved your book, especially because of the fierce individualism of all the women in it. My question to you would be, feminism seems to have gone from a place of women mothering each other to othering each other. And do we need a new model? And if so, where will it come from, especially in a gender fluid, race fluid, class, caste fluid world? Thanks so much. Would love to hear your thoughs about this. Goodbye.
I love that question.
I love that question. I love the gender fluid, race fluid, class, caste fluid world. But essentially, Gayatri is saying feminism used to be, or at least in theory, used to be about women mothering each other, looking after, nurturing each other. And it's gone to othering each other. In other words, saying, well, you know, you're not a proper feminist. Do we need a new model, she asks, and where will it come from?
I love the idea of mothering or othering. And I think I would disagree, actually, that if we went from a mothering model to an othering model, because I think it was more about sisterhood, which feels more equal, actually. But it was an unequal sisterhood, for sure. And I would say that the young women today, the ones that I come across, are much more intersectional in their approach than the older generation of feminists, who perhaps are more rigid in their thinking around feminism. The whole trans issue, and I think you said caste and class, is incredibly complicated. What I think needs to happen with trans and feminism is that we need to have those conversations. We need to listen to each other. There is a lot of defensiveness, and there is also a lot of conflict and anger around it. And we need to get to the stage where there is more education about it before people make pronouncements.
Bernadine, thank you very much indeed for that. And a question now that comes from Germany. It's from Jackie Mercy, who is Anglo-French, one English parent, one French parent. But she's taken German nationality because of Brexit, which is... Here she is with her question.
Hi, Bernadine. Here, Jackie from Munich, who lived in Hackney in the 80s. Thank you so much for Girl, Woman, Other. My question relates to the term half-caste, which is used throughout the book, a term which is now considered to be racist. Was it not considered offensive in the 80s when parts of the book were set? Thank you for taking the time to answer my question.
Now, I was called a half-caste when I was growing up because I'm mixed race. Half-caste was the accepted term for people who are mixed race, and it continued through the 80s. I would say the shift probably happened in the 90s. So in terms of me using the term half-caste in the book, I am being historically accurate, for sure. So that's the answer, short and sweet, really. It wasn't offensive. I never saw it as offensive. Perhaps other people did, but it was an accepted term to describe people of mixed race. And as often happens, the term changes and then it's considered as an insult. You know, people are insulted by the term that was previously used. So, for example, coloured, and then it became black, and coloured became an insult. I use the term off colour, and that's, to me, is a very inclusive and useful shorthand to use. Mixed race is also problematic because, to be honest, everyone's mixed race.
Thank you very much for that, Bernadine. And I think time for another reading from Girl, Woman, Other. In this part, we're with Carol, who, as we've said, who's this ambitious, high-flying businesswoman and black. And that combination causes her daily irritations and challenges.
She's used to clients and new colleagues looking past her to the person they are clearly expecting to meet. She will stride up to the client, shake his hand firmly, yet femininely, while looking him warmly, yet confidently, in the eye, and smiling innocently, and delivering her name unto him with perfectly clipped received pronunciation, showing off her pretty, thank God they're not too thick, lips, coated in a discreet shade of pink, bearing her perfect teeth as he adjusts to the collision between reality and expectation, and tries not to show it, while she assumes control of the situation and the conversation. It's all about having the upper hand with Carol, who takes these little conquests, as she imagines them, when she can. Perhaps he'll find himself unexpectedly attracted to her, which the more sophisticated try to hide, unlike the Nigerian petrochemical billionaire a few years ago, who wanted to expand his investment portfolio into copper, who invited her to a working lunch at the Savoy, only for her to discover it was in his private dining room in the royal suite. As if she was the kind of woman who'd amputate her aspirations to become one of his decorative appendages. She had to politely extricate herself from his intentions without jeopardising the business. Furious, he wanted to undermine her hard-won professionalism.
Bernadine Evaristo, thank you very much. And everything about Carol's life is hard won. I mean, she's had to overcome this really damaging trauma as a teenager when she was gang raped by a lot of boys. She'd been this rather brilliant student at school and that knocked her right off the tracks. So she's had a hard and painful past. And we have a question about that from Amanda Campbell, who's in North Carolina in the USA, in Charlotte in North Carolina. And her email says, I love the character development of Carol in your book. And the sentence spread out one word per line. Then her body wasn't her own no more. It belonged to them. Stopped me. Hauntingly beautiful. Patricia Hill Collins writes in her Black Feminism book that violence against black bodies needs to be displayed on the page because black women, in quotes, are twice victimised by the act and collective rape under slavery. I'm curious why you included Carol's journey in your novel and why it's meaningful to have these conversations of violence on black female bodies. I believe it is an important conversation we need to have more often on vulnerability and victimisation.
It's part of life, isn't it? It's a part of life that is very rarely talked about. I'm not just talking about black women, I'm just talking about women generally. I don't know the stats on the number of women who are sexually abused, but we know it's shockingly high. And I feel it's my duty as a writer to go there. By the time Carol is raped, you've got to know her just a little bit. And you know she's just a sweet little girl. She's a child. And because she thinks she's older than she is. And she's abused by these men in a terrible way. And it's absolutely traumatising. And because we live in a society where people don't talk about this, and also a judgmental society where actually, if you are sexually abused, whether that's rape or whatever else, there is sometimes this underlying attitude that somehow you asked for it. I had to think about it quite carefully because I don't want to sensationalise it. I don't want it to be making a statement about black men raping black women, which is why if anyone reads carefully, they will see that the characters are racially ambiguous, the boys, especially Trey, because I did not want to have a black male rapist, because that is a stereotype of black men. And then I didn't necessarily want it to be the defining thing about Carol's life either. It's something that she goes through. She comes out stronger as a result of it. It continues to haunt her, but it isn't the defining thing of her life. It doesn't stop her ambition to enter the world that she wants to belong to, which is essentially the white ruling class. You know, Carol has sold her soul to the beasts of the corporate world. She has. And that's what she feels she has to do to survive. And it's working. And in a sense, it's the same as her mother, Bumi, who has a lot of tragedy in her younger life and then eventually comes out of it and has a good life. I'm so disinterested in writing characters who are victims in terms of their characters and personalities. They may go through things that could make them victims, or they are victims of circumstance, but they are still strong in spite of that. And perhaps one of the reasons why this book has landed so well with so many readers, especially women, is because there is so much hope there.
Bernadine Everester, thank you very much for that. And a question now emailed from Turkey by Bushra Bulut, who says, my four friends and I and our professor have been reading English literature texts for 4 years. Our book club's last text was Girl, Woman, Other that we read in lockdown. We read it with pleasure. Many thanks for this great book. My question is, would this novel have won the Booker Prize 10 years ago?
I don't think so. It wouldn't have got anywhere near the Booker Prize. Until probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I don't think there was a single judge of colour, actually. I'm not saying that white judges are not going to choose books by writers of colour, because clearly they have done in the past. The fact that a black woman hadn't won the prize up to now tells you that the book wouldn't have won 10 years ago. It only won in 2019 when something has shifted in the culture around race and gender. And that was brought about by the Black Lives Matter movement first time round and the Me Too movement.
And many congratulations yet again.
Thank you.
We've got a caller on the phone for you now, Bernadine Everesto, in New London in Connecticut in the USA. He's Daniel Gula. Daniel, hi.
Hello. How are you, Bernadine?
I'm very well, thank you.
My question, I wonder if one of your objectives was to demonstrate what is to me obvious, a bone structure and skin pigmentation never extinguishes commonalities amongst human beings. Thank you.
So was one of your objectives in the book to demonstrate that race, colour, skin colour, it is not a big divider of people? And we have another question that's in the same ballpark from Alessia da Silva, who says, if readers could learn only one thing from Girl, Woman, Other, what would you want it to be? So was your objective to show that black, brown, white, you know, we're pretty much all the same?
I think it is a big divider, actually, simply because even though race is a construct, it is also a lived experience. And racism is something that we experience as people of colour. And so skin colour, features and so on are dividers. But at the same time, of course, we have our shared humanity as human beings. And if people get from my book our shared humanity, and I think that is what's happening with it, that people are reading it who are not black women, and they're connecting to the characters on all kinds of levels, then that is a fantastic result.
Well, thank you. And with that, we have to leave it. Next month, we're in Australia, albeit in a virtual sort of way, talking with the multiply award-winning Australian author Helen Garner about her novel The Spare Room. It's a story of two women's friendship that's tested to breaking point by illness, and we'd love your questions about it. We must have them by the 8th of July, so you'll need to move fast, but it's easy to get them to us. You can email, tweet us at BBCWBC, or post a question on our Facebook page. Further details on our website, where you can also download 200 World Book Club podcasts, interviews with the world's greatest authors, from Toni Morrison to Hisham Mattar, Andrea Levy to Anne Tyler. But for now, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and producer Karen Holden, thank you to our wonderful sound engineer, Matilda Macari. Thank you to all you members of BBC World Book Club, wherever you are. And thanks especially to this month's guest, Bernadine Everesto. Bernadine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was really interesting to do.
If you've enjoyed this World Book Club podcast, why not leave us a rating and review on your podcast app? And there are other podcasts from the BBC World Service you might like. In the series Witness, history is told by the people who were there. First-hand accounts of some of the most important events to have helped shape our lives and the places where we live. There are 5 podcasts a week and an incredible archive to delve into.
Er sagte, egal wohin ich gehe, er würde mich finden und ich würde ihn nicht kommen sehen.
Verstecken ist zwecklos.
Ist alles okay? Adrian ist tot. Er ist nicht tot. Er hat einen Weg gefunden, sich unsichtbar zu machen.
Das ist lächerlich. Erlebe der Unsichtbare. Jetzt vorab digital erhältlich.
Hören Sie mir zu!
Gespielt von der herausragenden Elizabeth Moss. Express Köln.
Zeig dich! Komm schon!
Der Unsichtbare. Downloaden und behalten. Erhältlich auf Sky, Amazon Prime, Apple TV und Google.